This is a Rosicrucian Fellowship Summer School. And since it's a summer school, I thought it would be a good idea for us to have a quiz. However, because I'm such an egoist, I want it to be the whole business. So I will ask the questions and give the answers. Of course, this more likely means that I'll choose questions that'll make me look good. And that's what I had in mind. I have, when I started making the notes, I thought, this is one where I can set myself up. And then along struck one of my favorite sayings, which I believe is from Proverbs, and that is, the wise shall be captured in their folly. And that's exactly what happened, because even though I set myself up with very simple questions, it turns out that even these most basic and simple questions prove to be very, very difficult. And so the answers were not satisfactory, and I might not look really good after all. So now what we're going to do is the same thing that we do if a person becomes a newspaper reporter or an investigator of one kind or another. You ask all of the interrogatory questions. You use the interrogatory words. Who, what, when, where, how, and why. You might add whence and whither, but that gets a little too much of a thing. So in these talks, actually all of these talks, I have been trying to answer some of those questions, only it hasn't been overt. Now it seems to be appropriate to be overt and ask a few of those questions in the most direct way possible, because they turn out to be very practical when you do that, even though it takes me a long time to get to the practical things. The first question involves how. And the question simply is, how do we know that cause and consequence are connected? That seems like an absurd question, because it's so simple, because everybody knows that consequences come from causes. However, a lot of things that we assume we know, we might not really well know, or we might not know what's involved in them. We have a lot of assumptions, and when we tackle some very simple questions, things get difficult really quickly. Now, because this is a question that is very fundamental, it is also very worthwhile, and it has a lot of good practical application. Now, this is a question that a lot of people have discussed. The academic philosophers have discussed it at great length. But for academic philosophers, it's not a matter of practicality. It's theoretical. They want to keep everything on a theoretical level. In spiritual philosophy, we want to know something that we can use. We're very useful. We always seek usefulness in everything that we try to do, and we try to keep it in that vein. Now, in academic philosophy, this was carried to the greatest extent by the Scotch philosopher named David Hume. Now, David Hume was an empiricist, which means that he believed that only the things that could be seen or proved through the senses were worthy of philosophy. He marked the stage in philosophy when empirical science was beginning, and he didn't like the pie in the sky of so much abstract philosophy that went back to the days of Plato. Now, obviously, because he was an empiricist, he had not seen God, and he was an atheist. And the people of Scotland knew that, and they didn't take it very easily. And there's a story about David Hume being out for a walk and getting into one of those areas where you can get into trouble, and he got into a bog, and he got stuck. Woman comes by, and he asks for help in being pulled out, and she recognizes that it's David Hume, and she won't help him to be pulled out until he says the Lord's Prayer. I don't know if that is a completely factual story or whether it's just an anecdote, but it's believable of the people of Scotland. But even though he was an atheist, he had a very excellent philosophical spirit. He was a contemporary of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau became sort of a pariah among all of the philosophers about the time of the French Revolution. He was one of the people who was supposedly that precipitated the French Revolution. And he sought, he came to England and he sought refuge there. And the only person that really treated him humanely was David Hume. But in his famous treatment of causality, David Hume used the example of billiard balls. And the way he describes it, he says one ball rolls up to another and strikes it. And you hear a click, and you see both balls roll off. And he says that what we perceive are different phenomena. We have seen different phenomena, including the click and the balls moving off with English or whatever, though the Scots probably wouldn't call it English. And what he says we see are different events, but we haven't seen causation. And causation, because it's invisible, is doubtful. Now, clearly, he's never played a lot of pool himself. Because if he had, he would know that pool players can cause the balls to do sometimes exactly what they want them to do. And some billiard sharks or pool sharks are so good that they can hide their skill by making it all seem as if it was just a lucky shot. This is how they make their money. So to the pool player or the billiard player, there is no doubt that there is cause and consequence because they prove it to themselves by their own skill. But even at that, Hume would go so far as to say that they were practicing seeing actions of different phenomena which were not necessarily causal, and that they were really people of faith. They had faith that there was a causal relationship. And these are the kinds of things that empiricists and other materialists get themselves into. For us as mystical aspirants, we feel it's quite an accomplishment be able to cause things to happen that we want them to happen. Because of that average, a lot of things that are important to us isn't very good. And so we have people like St. Paul saying, the good that I would, I do not. Because we're not always that in control of cause. Nonetheless, by the terms of Hume, we haven't perceived causation either. Now, normally, if you're in a conversation and you ask this question, how do we know that cause and consequence are connected? In most spiritual circles, what you'll probably hear is, we know they're connected because of intuition. Now, that's a pretty good answer. But the intuition is also individual. And we don't always know what is intuition, because in some ways we are as blind about intuition as we are about causation in pool balls. Very often we have impulses of desire that lower nature can be very good at imitating, and we have impulses that seem like they are intuitions and they are really not intuitions. It can make it even feel as though it were a discovery when it's not a discovery. So it's obvious that sometimes we have opinions and we think those opinions are intuitions. The opinions may even have had their origin in intuitions before they became just opinions. So if we want to have that answer, we have to ask what intuition is. Now, cause and consequence is a principle. And as a principle, it comes from the realm of abstract or ideational thought. However, intuition, the Iranian type of intuition that we're speaking of, comes from a higher level. It comes from the level of life spirit. And life spirit is pure truth. Not a truth like a principle, but it is pure truth. So cause and consequence themselves and the principle of cause and consequence are the offspring of truth. So we might say that if we are having an intuition and it is a true intuition, it comes from the unity of life spirit. And in the unity of life spirit, the connection can, between cause and consequence, can be seen. It's not seen the way we see things with our eyes. It is seen with truth. With truth, there is that unity that connects all things, and that is as real to the consciousness of life spirit as our ocular perceptions are here in this world. So we're talking about something unconditioned and unconditional. From the region of life spirit is where Christ expresses. From the region of life spirit, Christ speaking can say, I came to fulfill the law, not to destroy it. And Christ then the Lord of the law, because Christ being in life spirit and the representative of that state of spiritual being is the source of the law, or is beyond it and is over it. So we can say that we truly know that the principle of cause and consequence is true, and that it functions when we have that experience of life spirit, and we know that in that unity, cause and consequence are connected. At this point, we have some satisfaction, even though we're talking in terms of secondhand experience of life spirit. Of life spirit in our consciousness, we're content in our insecurity and in our proving of all things as the Bible tells us to do, so that we do have some understanding that cause and consequence are connected, and there really is a reasonable way that connection can be spoken about. So we have to rephrase the question at that point and understand what the question means for our lives. What does it mean that cause and consequence are connected? What does it mean that cause and consequence are connected, and that we know that they are connected because we can transcend and have our being in the realm beyond cause and consequence? We can put our consciousness, if we are very fortunate, into the realm of life spirit. And we can rise to that wellspring from which cause and consequence derive. But most of the time we live here in the chemical region of the physical world. And here in the chemical region of the physical world, we're pretty blind. And we have a host of temptations about which we're pretty habitual. So that we sin pretty regularly, and we have our own personal syndromes of bad living. Now, if we are operating from the unity and continuity of life spirit, that is, if we are beyond the law, It means we are free. And it means that we are free to interject new causes into the stream of cause and consequence. Put the new things that have never been before. And we can interject new things to change the direction of flow of causes and consequences. If we're even beyond the principle, we can see why a certain consequence is coming to us in one principle. We have abused that what would bring suffering to us if we came to that consequence, and we can see how to fulfill that principle without having to go through something painful or something that is limiting. So this means that when this is what the Christian life means. It doesn't mean that there is no cause and consequence. It means that we, along with Christ, have the freedom to interject causes into the stream. We can change things. We're born anew, and we can see the truth of things when they do occur, and we can see them in a better way. This holds true no matter how we look at time, whether we look at linear time or spiral time or circular time or momental time, as we talked about last night. This is creative living. We are admonished to live the life. And when we live the life, even if we're not capable of introducing new causes, we're capable of seeing things in new ways. This is what it means to be born again. We see things a totally different way. Everything is new, everything fresh, we're filled with gratefulness almost like a little child. People who tend to think of cause and consequence in the way that they believe that they're part of the system and that it's determined, and they have that doom of fate in their being rushed downhill like the pigs toward the sea in the Bible. Story have that sense it's terrible, and what they want to do is they want to escape the wheel of rebirth because it's heavy and it is onerous. It's a little bit feeling sorry for yourself, but egoism is what got us into this problem. Egoists like myself always feel sorry for ourselves. We want to make it easier for ourselves, just to make it harder. But the personal psychology and the cosmic evolutionary psychology, in both of them we find that it is healthy to follow through on what we have started. And what we have started is a trajectory into matter, and because we fell, we have come more deeply into matter than was intended. We have all kinds of problems when we don't follow through on our actions. Eventually life becomes insipid, and soon we don't believe that there are options, that we just have to run downhill and face all of these hard consequences. And what, how do they say it? The shit runs downhill. And whoever said that life was supposed to be pleasant, all those kinds of things like that. Pretty soon people can't see opportunities to interject new things into cause and consequence. And no wonder people want to escape. And so there is something, it's easy to understand why people want to escape the wheel of rebirth. However, if they can experience the newness, the novelty, the fresh spirit, seeing things in a totally different way that comes from the life spirit, then life can be seen in a totally different way. I don't know what the consequences are if a person has a lot of soul power and practices all kinds of meditation and can try to escape the wheel of rebirth. what happens? They don't grow anymore after that, because here, right here, is where we unfold self-consciousness. After we die, we don't unfold self-consciousness. We return to the self-consciousness we had in the past, and in a much higher way. We're not developing anything new. It's only in those discoveries when we're waked up at the same time that we're waking matter up, those bumps that we get on the head in the material world, that the self-consciousness grows from. So if someone drops out, in a way, it's sort of like the oboe player leaving the symphony, and because his part is too difficult to play and it's tedious and he just doesn't want to do it anymore. And since everything is attuned to the oboe, everything goes, you know, the piece isn't full after that. We're in this together. And when we have spiritual realizations, we realize we are one. And then in that oneness, if there is a way that we can all outgrow this, and that we can all fulfill this, and that we can all lift each other up, not necessarily that we think of ourselves in an egoistic way that's giving it all, we can do things to go forward, and we can have that healthy follow-through of completing the commitment that we have to the evolution and creation. Now, it seems at this point important to clarify something. Now, because we are spiritually aware, and because we are aspiring, probably each and every one of us is burdened by the indignity of having to be here in the limitations of this world. Everything is cramping, especially when we do get a hint of higher things and universal things. And when untransformed causes come back to us in the form of illness, we have to deal with the problem. Or we have to deal with the people who represent the parts of us that are unregenerate, that are reflecting our destiny back to us. We want divinity. We deserve something better. But what we do to attain that is what is important. There's a big difference between graduating from the school of life and outgrowing, or fleeing and trying to escape. Fleeing and trying to escape, you think of it in the school analogy, produces a dropout. We have the power and the ability to make it very serious and so on this line. I don't want to dwell on negatives like this, but there is a tendency. These ideas that I don't think are spiritually wholesome are prevalent and they're around. And we have so much egoism that people are ready to be tempted by them. It's as if people think the law wasn't functioning for them. That our condition here wasn't exactly what we needed. And it didn't represent our divine dignity. You know, it's kind of absurd to say that the law, which works perfectly, really isn't working perfectly. All right, now let's work back and return to exploring some positives of the relationship of creation to cause and consequence, the relationship between volition and necessity, whereby we can do more than what is asked of us, and what is a pain to some people, and that is a heavy task to some people, is a joy to us because we're doing much more than is intended or necessary. It's a wonderful joy turning it into something positive. Sometimes, in our spiritual experience, we get a little taste of eternity. When we get a taste of eternity, we tend to look down on time. Time, which is really the handmaiden of eternity. And it is in time that creative causes ripen and that they mature and they develop beautiful creative consequences. It's a difficult matter because the world in which we materialize our causes, which we carry out our creation, fights back. And it is that fighting back, that resistance, that causes us to give everything that we have to our cause. And when we do that, when we give everything, we give our divinity, and we actually realize our causes and the consequences. It's because we've given everything we have to the creatures that depend on us that those creatures themselves are raised up by the things that have been given to them by us. So, this is, it's not an easy thing. Things don't always come out the way we want them to, because the world fights back. And because we really don't know for certain what we want. We have a spiritual image of a creative dream, but that dream has to be realized. I don't think there's ever been a painter that accomplished everything in his painting that he wanted. It's never what we wanted. I've never given a talk that is what I wanted. It always falls far short. There's a lot of things missing. The timing is off, or things are imperfect. It's always like that. These things have to be brought to life, and they have to be brought to life by our sacrifice. And these are all very fine things. When we're dealing with life, we're not just dealing with the dream kept as a daydream. We're dealing with life as a reality. This is the real thing. There isn't a dress rehearsal. We're right here. We're living in it. We ourselves, as we have come to be in form like this, are the realization of the creative dreams of the gods. We are the product of their creative endeavors. All of this has come about within and because of time and the law that manifests within time. So this is another reason to be very positive about time, and it is another reason for looking at the interplay between life spirit and human spirit, love and the law, creation and manifestation of creation. Without time, there'd be no music. Notes would be in all kinds of jumbled ways. And there's nothing better than the perfection of music in the perfect time. Even the rest is always perfectly timed. Time is the parent of perfection. Eternity is the perfect, but the perfection is brought about in by time. Creation is brought about by life spirit. The law is perfected. It is carried out. And since it is a creative activity, what we get from the law back. We may not like what we see in the mirror of the law, but it is perfectly accurate. We get exactly what we need to improve ourselves and improve our creative endeavors. It's important to change our lives. Now, if you're not too egoistically invested in yourself, and realize that in time this reflection of the law is not the end, we can creatively introduce new things to make it better. This is a very important concept. I'm dwelling on it because we don't have to be fated. We don't have to have a salvation or a redemption at the end of time. We can have it at every instant of time. We have opportunities day by day by day to make this a more glorious place. it isn't heaven on earth, but earth can be awfully wonderful. That's what it's supposed to be. It's God's creation. If we look at nature, it's tremendously beautiful. There are things that are very awing to us. When we're operating from life's spirit, and we're doing that, whether it's just in simple intuitions or whether it's in creative imaginations, we're operating with the consciousness of the all. We're operating with the consciousness as seen by others. And we literally see ourselves as others see us. In any good creation, the creation is a gift to others for them to see the world and themselves in a better way. And that's exactly what that does. When we're working from this advantage or from this vantage, we can interject objective, impersonal acts and corrections, and we can do it not for our own sake, but beyond people, we can do it for Christ's sake. And if we do that, we are reaching our perfect. We're even commanded to do it. We're told, be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. So we're in the interplay between time and eternity, between self and Christ, between life spirit, the human spirit and life spirit, and in reflection in the interplay between vital body and desire body. This is an extremely important interplay. In the Rosicrucian philosophy, we are told that all consciousness is a result of this interplay, especially here phenomenally in the struggle between the vital body and the desire body, the use of the dense physical body. Our lives, which are our stream of cause and consequence, of various duration and various scopes, our creation, our process of becoming, this is what we are doing. We are part of that ocean. We are a current within that ocean. It's very important to us. Now, the law has its home among other principles in the region of creational thought. Those principles can be made express things that are beautiful or ugly, but they are all, because they are within the one and the one is love, they are all good, making and ultimately there cannot be any evil in all of this. Now the manifest becoming from principles occurs in time. Time ripens the thought seeds that we make them into consciousness. Because of the blessing of time, our creative manifestations in actions don't have to turn out ugly. Even if they start in that direction, we can turn them another way. Creation isn't only at the beginning. Creation is there every step of the way. Every instant of time offers another opportunity for creation. Even if it's only looking at this object in a different way. This is truly why the reason why we try to live longer, because there's always a possibility that we can give love birth in the world in a new way. And sometimes people can be born into love in the right minute, especially if they're suffering. I don't believe in much efforts to keep a person alive by all artificial means or things like that, but you can understand why people who are desperate for salvation because they know they haven't been creating all along feel that way. Each moment, we're given another chance. That's what grace is. We always have another chance at doing things. So the creation is not at the beginning. It's there all along the way. This is one of the implications of that grand statement of Christ in St. John's Gospel, the says, I am the way. Meaning to say that this is the only purposeful, meaningful, creative, loving thing, way that we can have. By that I don't mean any Christian sectarianism or anything like that. I'm talking about that state of being as it is, as its nature is. Anything can be redeemed. Anything can be transformed into something beautiful. And it's done on the fly. We can't stop and wait until conditions are better before we do it. We have to do it in motion. That's one of the bad habits we've gotten in materialism. We look at things in stopped action. You know, we look at a horoscope. A horoscope is the dynamics of the heavens, which are constantly changing. We see it in stopped action, and that gives us an idea of the moment that is an entire life. But in reality, life is going on, and it's going on very fast, and we had better adjust to doing things on the fly, doing things on the wing, as things are moving along, if we want to have spiritual life, because that's what spiritual life is. We can transform and we can reform ugly things into beautiful things. If you think about it, because of the suit that we're in, and because of recycling, our reformation and regeneration are the greater part of our working life. Very, very rare that we get to introduce something that is completely new, something that is totally unprecedented, but we have all of these things of ourselves that we have to redeem, we have to transform. By recycling, we use the same stuff all over again, and it's the same stuff that we're using all over, our old attitude from the past, we've been hanged on or angry or something like that, that's what we have to transform. Jesus, I'm like a preacher tonight. I'm sorry, I guess got into the spirit of the new, and I'm carrying along a little too hard, a little too strong here. If we look at many of human creations, they look quite ugly. We look at many deeds, they seem to be not pretty, they seem to be not harmonious. Somebody just sent me a video about one of those things that are caused by squirrels, by all the trouble that they get into. And before you could look at that video, you had to look at an ad about drugs. I just cleaned it off the screen. No video is that important to me that I want to read about drugs and the side effects of drugs and all of that. It's really pretty terrible. But in a way, our life as it is right now, because we've gotten ourselves in the fix that we are in, we can look at our lives almost like those artists who take pieces out of junk heaps and take works of art out of them. And until we can work more fully within the stuff of creation, that's sort of what we're doing. We're creating and drawing beauty out of ugliness at the same time that we're drawing goodness out of what is it. There's much more that we can say about this. I don't think I want to go on to it because it gets awfully heavy. So we've got to turn to some other questions in our quiz. We've got to the point that we're talking about time, so probably the next question that we look into in our quiz should be an interrogatory about time. Derogatory term for time is when. And so obviously the next question, which we answered quite a bit this morning in the astrology talk, is when does a cause become a consequence? It's another absurd sounding question, but it's an important one. When does a cause become a consequence? Now, in a timeless and eternal state, in a state like life spirit, the question is unnecessary because cause and consequence, or even paradoxes and logical opposites, are united in that perfect kind of unity. It is not something that we ask at that level, because what we are experiencing is something very different. And in the phenomenal realms, especially deep in the phenomenal realms where we are right now, it's either so difficult or that it seems silly to even ask that question. When does a cause become a consequence? It seems silly. In order for a cause to become a consequence, there has to be a difference between a cause and a consequence. So with this question, we are in effect asking, what is the difference between a cause and a consequence? If one thing or one state of being becomes another thing, or another state of being, we're talking about change. We're talking about transformation. And when we look at change, we can see that there is change in something relative to itself or relative to something else. If we change an attitude within ourselves, that is a change within ourselves. If we change position relative to something else, we have then made a change that is of the second variety, a change of location. However, as, I don't know how to say these things. As single entities that are capable of changes ourself or changes relative to things outside of ourselves, we can't know about changes other than ourselves except within our own being, because the knowing and the intuition is within us. If we look contrarily, we cannot know about changes in ourselves without seeing changes in the external world. So the two are interdependent with each other. And what we're talking about here is a very difficult epistemology, a knowing, how we know things. We can see that change and the knowledge of change within oneself is an interdependent matter. It happens in spirit and it happens in time. Change relative to something else is something that happens in space. So we're at the very fundamental level of manifest being within the potentials of time and space when we're looking at the most fundamental kind of change that can be made. We cannot know of a change in time without knowing something about space. And we can't know about a change in space without knowing something about time. The two are interdependent. They are the potential, the framework in which manifest change takes place. So you might say then time and space are co-attributes of one potential. So when we ask a question about time, like a when question, it is also a part of a where question. It's a matter of time and space. So what we're asking is, at the same time that we're asking when does a big cause become a consequence, we're also asking where does a cause become a consequence, which is even a more absurd kind of question. If a cause becomes a consequence, there has to be a moment, an instant, when it changes from one state to another. And when something changes from one state to another, that is knowable, that is recognizable, that is experiential, we call that moment an event. The same thing in the physics as it is in our inner spiritual psychology. If there is no event, the cause continues on as a cause. Some causes even continue on as causes when they have become consequences and they spawn other consequences. So this is something that gets very complex very quickly. Now, there are several practical things in life about this. One is that to learn and benefit or experience benefit from a cause, it must precipitate an event. And it must be a proportional event. Using the wider definition or connotation of cause, we sometimes love or desire a cause in such a way that we want to hang on to it. And we don't want it to become a consequence. One of the most perfect examples, and that is a big issue in our country right now, is when we don't want sexual activity to come to its natural consequence. We want to have the pleasure of the sexuality without the consequence of it, because we don't want the responsibility, without really realizing the responsibility is there all along. Another example, and probably a very sick one, is bulimia. We want to have the pleasure of the cause of bringing wonderful sensations to our tongue, but we don't want to gain weight. And so we do everything we can to have the pleasure of a certain kind of cause without the consequence. And probably the best example of hanging on to a cause and not letting it become a consequence is daydreaming. We want to have our daydream in which everything is perfect. And we want it not to come into fruition, because if it comes into fruition because of the imperfections of the world, it won't be perfect anymore. Now, because of the absolute unity of the One, we can't really have causes that don't have consequences. And even not bringing a cause to a consequence has its own consequence. And eventually, one who refuses to bring things to a state of an event, or one who does not bear fruit, and you're by their fruits ye shall know them, that person loses the ability to see opportunities. In this, the biblical Christ was very clear and very strong in his statement. Let your yeas be yeas, and let your nays be nays. Stand by what you say you will do and what you will not do, and do what you're doing. Carry it out. That's a really strong statement. We get as much from a consequence as we put into the cause. Obviously, if we are not allowing our causes to come to fruition, we're holding back and we're not getting anything out of them. It's a rather sickly existence to live in a daydream. I've done quite a bit of it in my days, and I am repulsed by it now. From time to time, I even try to fantasize, and I can't do it anymore because I find it an utterly boring and insipid activity. And it's to me, it's like chewing gum. I can't chew gum because you're chewing to no purpose, to no end. And it has that feeling of emptiness and futility. Now, this doesn't mean that we forego subtle causes and that we have to be grunting about everything that we do, because there are subtle things that have to be carried out, and they come to their consequences only. It just means that we maintain an intent in what we do, in the causes that we belong to, the causes that issue from us, we carry the intent of bringing it to fruition. Now, a second practical thing about this is timing. Every cause has its own maturation in time to bring it out from its own inception. Now, there are cases where the timing can be changed. They're very rare. One case is Max Heindel, because he was at the crucial part of doing the Rosicrucian work. His life was extended by a few weeks by himself and an adept working on the archetype of his life so that he could carry out just a few more things that were necessary in the foundation of the Rosicrucian Fellowship. But basically, the archetype of a life, just like the archetype of every other thing, even a car that's just about to be scrapped, has its own sense of, timing. There is a time for it, carries as far as it is to be carried. It ripens. In my youth, I have Mars in the first house, and the early part of life is ruled by the first house. I used to try to preemptively force issues just to have them over. And because of that, trying to force issues, I even tried to force people into making decisions when they weren't ready to make decisions. And the consequences were always disastrous because the timing was off. There is something about living our lives that we have to have the timing, that we don't try to delay things because we want to hang on to them as they are now, or just because we're lazy and don't want to do the work to bring them to fruition, and the at the other extreme, forcing issues or acting preemptively or something like that. The reality is that fruit that has been forced to ripeness doesn't taste as good as fruit that ripens naturally. And fruit that has gone past ripeness and has an element of decay in it doesn't taste as good as perfectly ripe fruit. A perfect analogy for sensing timing in our lives, the same timing we were talking about with music before. In a broad manner, we want our lives to be consequential. So it behooves us to live in our causes and to understand the time of them so that they come ripe when they can. If we don't have a life of causes, we have a life that has no fruit. And that's a rather sickly kind of life, a life without fruit. Let's look at one last question, because we're just about overstayed here again. Let's look at one that we just asked a little bit ago. That is the partner question to the previous one. And that is, where does a cause become a consequence? Where does a cause become a consequence? For this, there is an indefinite or a relative answer. There is a general answer, but in order for it to be applied, there has to be a specific relevance. The reason why it is indefinite or relative means that the subject, the spirit who precipitates the cause, has different intents, and some of those intents are precipitated in different places. The best general simple answer to the question of where does a cause become a consequence, the answer is without. The process of creation, from going from the perfect of life spirit where everything is unity and bringing out a new creation and bringing it to fruition and realizing something that was potential in matter before and bringing that new realization into back into the spirit, is a process of externalization. And when the externalization is completed or carried as far as it can go, or when it is as ripe as it can be ripe, that is as far external as we can bring that cause. Now, the without is a relative thing, because some things, it's enough that we objectify a thought. Some thoughts do not have to be carried all the way into matter. Other thoughts or other creations go as far as emotions. There are things that we share emotions, and we have an emotional life that is just as important and as real as our material life, and by carrying things into being in the emotions, that's enough. But it has to be externalized. Again, the same thing happens with daydream or with fantasy. We keep something inside of us. And when it is kept inside of us, it is never realized. And our creative capacity does not become strong because we haven't gone through the slings and arrows of fortune in order to bring it to fulfillment. In the same way that we bring a child into its life, there's a lot of sacrifice, there's a lot of hard work to bring a child up so that child can have the realization of life in the best way that's possible to it. And the same thing is true with creation. Unless we take our dreams and externalize them and make them something that is useful and helpful to the world around us, we lose our creative capacity. It is just as we thought, as I mentioned it before, when we externalize it, it's never what we thought it was going to be. It's never as good. It doesn't seem as great as that wonderful creative impulse or that wonderful creative dream that we had inside of ourselves. That's because the value of the external world is imperfection. And in those imperfections and doing the best that we can with them, we wake up the potency of the spirit. So if we never externalize, we sink into a state of vaguer and vaguer creative dreams. But what happens when we externalize something and bring it out to its final and carry it as far as it can go, in that process, the spirit becomes more alive and vivid. So that when we turn within into ourselves again, the dream is more vivid than it was before we started the creative process. And it is because we did that. We're better parents for having brought children into the world and made all of those sacrifices. We are better creative beings for taking our artistic works and bringing them out and sharing them. Our dream then becomes the property of everyone. We don't have to wait until they're all capable of reading our minds, and nobody would want to read those insipid dreams in any way. This doesn't mean that we have to live completely extroverted lives, that we still have our nature that is more or less internal or extroverted, because we can see that to be completely extroverted is a trap. Material science right now is completely extroverted. All of the truth and all of the reality is out there. The subject that does the thinking and that understands and that has the intuition of truth is not important to them. If there were a way that they could eliminate the scientist except for the glory from an experiment, the scientists would surely do it that way. This is what it means when Christ says it is more blessed to give than to receive. For most of our evolutionary career, we have been involutionary. We have been creatures. We are the product, as we said earlier, of the creation of the gods. We have received everything. Everything has been taken care of us more than we take care of the needs of a baby. But now we have the creative fire within. And for us, it is much more blessed to be giving than to receiving. To be receiving. In fact, all the receiving that we do, the best of that comes in the process of giving. If I were to sit in my room all day and just contemplate these thoughts for myself, it would not be anywhere near as it is in the glory of trying to take the understanding of reality and share it with others. That in that process of creative giving, we get so much that it's almost incomprehensible to us. So what we're saying is not only are we to be outward beings, we are to be creative beings, and we are to be externalizing beings. We still are not perfect at that. We can't give up because our creations aren't good, and we can't give up because we have internal resistance. We have to really want it. And we have to really want it not on the basis of personal desire, personal ego. We have to be full with the Spirit. From the fullness of the heart, the mouth runneth over. And that is the kind of life that we want to live. And so this is what happens when we externalize creatively. Now there are a lot of other questions, very simple questions like these that we could ask, but we just don't have time. We could even ask the whence and whither of cause and consequence, and there would be answers. But since I took the quiz and I got some of the answers right or partially right, it's up for you to ask the other questions and to answer them. And so what we'll do instead, we will close with the Rosicrucian prayer, and we'll look at cause and consequence a different way tomorrow evening. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Yes.
Well, I had written down a question here, but I think I kind of answered the first one,
okay,
which leads to even a, I had written down, can a cause or consequence take place in the spiritual realms? Now, I know that part of that can, because, for example, if we have defective bodies when we come into the next lives, or even in this life, that is a consequence from not having built a proper body while on the other side.
Or yeah, okay.
But that leads to the next question. That must require at least time, if not space, in that realm.
Yes, but when you say spiritual realms, there are spiritual realms and there are spiritual realms. I thought I made it really clear that cause and consequence, as well as all causes and consequences, are born in abstract thought, in principles, in human spirit. That is, at that level, there is cause and consequence. There is not in life, spirit, and beyond. Now we're talking about something really deep now, spiritually. There is something in life spirit that results in cause and consequence, but you have to look at it at a totally different way because things are very different there. In life spirit, there is giving. And that giving is what cause and consequence is precipitated from. But the giving is not as direct and tendential as we think of giving. It is the nature of life spirit in order, in the same way that it lifes itself and that it loves itself within itself. It gives itself within itself, and it is self-regenerative. It is eternal and perpetually self-regenerative. And you might say from, it's described by people who have the experience of life spirit, that everything that is manifest creation is a great giving, and that great giving is something like a froth from something that is consistently or eternally spiriting itself. That is the nature of life spirit. It's always life, and we can't conceive of it at all the way we conceive of things here. And even after there has been a creation, and all of the essence of the creation goes back into life spirit, that going back into life spirit does change life spirit, but it isn't a taking back in the same way we take something back, like a redemption. It's just another form of giving to life spirit, that it is a form of giving that takes things back into itself, and there is no thought of self at all. The other, the infinite and eternal and universal other, is what life spirit is to itself. There's no thought of self at all. It's perpetually creating an other to give to. Now that's a very poor man's description of it, but nobody in the history of people who have had experience of Christ or of the life spirit can ever put that into words, and that's as close as I can come to it.
Okay, there's another thought that occurred to me, because it's almost like the chicken and egg question, which came first, mm-hmm. and that is the cause or the consequence. In that,
we're going to talk a little bit about that tomorrow.
Yes.
See, viewed again from life spirit, and even in the higher regions of human spirit, cause and consequence are a silhouette of the same thing. Cause and consequence are one and the same thing, but when it is put in the perspective of time and separation and differentiation, cause and consequence appear different. But there is what we talked about last night, that when a cause becomes a consequence, and when we pass through time, we are forever changed. So the consciousness and the outlook that is the difference between a cause and a consequence is what changes, but the stuff or the nature of cause-consequence as one thing is still what it is. There's an energy that creates, and that same energy destroys. When is it creative and when is it destructive? There is a moment where you determine that, but the energy is still the same. What the effect of the energy or what the understanding of it is in the agency that is using that energy is it's also all the same. It's a conscious change. Very hard to talk about. You need somebody, you need to get to the teacher where you can get a better answer for that than you can from me. I can only give the elementary answers. You got another question?
No, I had, but it's kind of answered in that. Because I had it written down, the question was, are time and space realms that are only available to beings such as us? Because whether it be and if so, only are they in the spiritual realms, or are they only in the physical realms?
They're paraspiritual and they're paraphysical. They are potential. There is being and there is non-being. The non-being is within the absolute as well as everything that is. So between the supreme being, which is everything that is, and the absolute, which is everything that is, that everything that isn't, and things that are beyond our comprehension, there has to be a no man's land between them. And that no man's land between them that is not known and it is not unknown is called potential. It is not what is, but it is what could be. And the pole of potential that spirit works in is the pole of time. And when it's taking out of what we call universal space, which is called cosmic root substance in the Rosicrucian philosophy, that potential in space where those points actually are turned into real particular points, that is at the matter pole. So the potential of time and space becomes manifest as spirit and matter, but they are things that could be. And that could be is where, you know, like when we're ifing, if we are working creatively and imagining and projecting our imagination into potential, we're projecting it into time-space. And when we do that, it takes the same form as us. This is a much higher kind of causation. We are spirit-matter. And when we project, or when the Supreme Being does that in the most primal way possible, it is projecting itself, and that is what appears for potential to be in the way that potential is, because potential itself does not have any particular form, and it could be anything. That's why potential is polar in the same way that being is polar. Okay, any other questions? Ross said, if you think I'm going to retrospect this tonight, you've got another guest coming. Thank you very much.